DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be once again joined by Vivian Doudreau, who is an editor at Ignatius Press and has served as the editor for Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, a book by Grzegorz Górny, who is an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. He studied journalism at the University of Warsaw, Poland, and has written numerous articles and books on a variety of social and religious subjects. He has co-authored a number of books, including Trust, In St. Faustina's Footsteps, Witnesses to Mystery, Investigations into Christ's Relics, and Guadalupe Mysteries. With Vivian Doudreau, we go inside the pages of Grzegorz Górny's Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, published by Ignatius Press. Were the three kings, or magi, who the Bible says traveled to Jerusalem in search of the Christ child, real historical figures, or simply the stuff of legend? For generations, the magi have inspired art and music. Epiphany, the important Christian feast 12 days after Christmas, is a national holiday in many countries throughout the world. What lies at the heart of this celebration, and is it still relevant today? Turning to discoveries made by historians, scientists, and theologians, Polish author Grzegorz Górny answers these questions in his book, Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, The Secrets of Christmas and Epiphany. He traces the mystery of the Magi from the Gospel of Matthew to modern-day astronomy, to revived Epiphany celebrations on the streets of secularized European capitals. Pope Benedict XVI explains, "The men of whom Matthew speaks are not just astronomers. They were wise. They represent the inner dynamic of religion toward self-transcendence, which involves a search for truth, a search for the true God, and, hence, philosophy, in the original sense of the word." We now begin our discussion with Vivian Doudreau. Vivian, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here. My pleasure.
Let's talk about Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, The Secrets of Christmas and Epiphany. What a phenomenal book Ignatius Press once again brings to us.
Isn't it great? It's full of all of this fascinating information about the three kings, historical, scientific, and then these gorgeous four color photos and illustrations on every page. And then I love the fact that it's on the small side for a book of this nature. You know, sometimes these hardcover books, and in fact, we've done a number of books like this with this Polish publisher, Rosikon, and they're usually bigger, you know, and people sometimes refer to them as coffee table books and that kind of thing. But this is a little bit smaller, kind of fits in your hand. I love this book.
The thing that struck me right away is that it's worthy of the mysteries it speaks of. I mean, that's the kind of book that you want to have to be able to sit down, not only with children, but even with friends, just to have available to enter into these incredible insights on some of the holiest times in the life of our church.
Yes, it is worthy of the mysteries it delves into. And the author, Grzegorz Górny, the Polish journalist who wrote the book and who has written these other books that Ignatius has been co-publishing with Rosikon in Poland, all their books are interested in these sorts of topics, you know, the supernatural, the intersection of the physical and the spiritual, and this is like that. What can be believed? What can be plumbed? How much of the stories in the Gospels have historical veracity that can be believed? These are the questions they love to explore.
Well, let's talk about some of those. I mean, right off the bat, were there three kings or were they magi? I mean, how should we approach one of these mysteries?
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, do we believe that the gospel writers were telling us the truth to the degree that they were able? That do we take seriously their project of trying to tell the story of Jesus to the people who would come after them? Do we take them seriously? I think there's a lot of biblical scholarship that doesn't take these men seriously. They figure, oh, these are antiquated, credulous people before the scientific age. And so there's this very condescending attitude toward people in the past, as if we in the 21st century are so very smart and clever and know so much more than they do. And so these stories are approached as if they're just tales for children or something, and no longer worthy of belief. And so I think your starting point needs to be, these men experienced something profound, life-changing, and mysterious. They are trying to tell the story of these events for our benefit. Do we take them seriously? I think if we do, we experience the Gospels in a whole different way.
We have almost, forgive me, Vivian, but almost trivialized the three kings. They've become a part of the crush scene. And yet for most of the world, most of the Catholics, in their celebration of these great mysteries, they are the pinnacle. They're the peak of what the Christmas season is supposed to be about, aren't they?
Well, even the name of the feast, Epiphany, which is another word for, you know, a manifestation, a revelation, that the Christ child's identity as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords is manifested to the world when these three individuals, whether they were kings or just sages or astronomers, or, you know, the word magi kind of encompasses all of these things. When they arrive bearing gifts, this is breaking open into the world for the first time of who Jesus is. Now, the angels, as we know, told the shepherds, but that was, you know, like telling the locals. This is breaking it open to the whole world, and not just the Jewish world, to the pagan world as well. And so this feast has always been very important in the history of the church. And in some countries, as you've just mentioned, it's almost more important than Christmas Day. They save gift giving and so on for Epiphany.
I think we've lost the sense of it, haven't we? Only because we have this beautiful, wonderful Thanksgiving period in the United States. And for the rest of the world, who they don't experience that, the Advent is a very quiet time that leads to a Christmas that almost should feel like our Thanksgiving. So that Christmas kicks it off and it leads to Epiphany. Here, we have this Thanksgiving that kicks it off. And by the time Christmas comes along, that's when all the lights happen. That's when all the experiences happen. And we're just so tired, aren't we? Maybe, am I being cynical, Vivian, that we don't have a sense of Epiphany?
Right. No, well, you know, we know that you find a lot of Christmas trees out on the curb the day after Christmas. Right. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who acknowledge Christmas anyway with decorations and so on don't even necessarily know that when we speak of the 12 days of Christmas, they begin on Christmas and extend to Epiphany. A lot of people think the 12 days of Christmas are the 12 days of eating and drinking in December, leading up to Christmas as they're going to parties and all the rest of it. No, the 12 days begin on Christmas. And if you count, you'll end up with January 6th, which was the traditional date for the Epiphany. Some dioceses now have transferred the celebration to a Sunday, so it isn't necessarily 12 days from Christmas. But yeah, exactly. We've put the crescendo on Christmas Day, where the crescendo used to be on Epiphany.
So there's a great gift, isn't there, when we can allow the church to guide us in the experience of that crescendo that you speak of, that ideally should end on Epiphany, because there's a mystery and awesome contained within those days, isn't there?
Yes, there are. There's a lot of spiritual fruit that's supposed to be ripening in this period between Christmas and Epiphany. The Christ child has been born, hopefully born in our hearts, first and foremost, because we prepared during Advent and made a little bit more room in some mm-hmm. little corner of our heart. We made a little bit more room for Jesus to take up a little more space. And now that he's there, what's the fruit of this? You know, well, I love that old hymn, King Wenceslaus. He goes out on the feast of what? The feast of Stephen, the day after Christmas, is when he goes out to bring food to the poor, right? This is the Christ has been born, and now where's the fruitfulness in our life? This is supposed to be transforming us, right? So those days after Christmas are supposed to be a continuation of fruitfulness. And then the arrival of the Magi, their wonder and their risk-taking to go in search of the Christ child, that's supposed to inspire us.
And when you look at those periods of days, a good reason to, again, the value and the beauty of recapturing them is that in that encounter, there's also the challenge of the struggle of the Christian life. And look at some of those days. There's some of the toughest days, like the killing of the innocent children.
Well, yes, isn't that a chilling feast to put right in the Christmas season? The slaughter of the innocents on the 28th, and of course the King Herod, his role in the Christmas drama is very, very important. The Magi go to him first. They go to the court of Israel. If a king is to be born, wouldn't the people at court know about this? So the Magi go to the court of Herod first, ask where is your Messiah supposed to be born? And then they consult with their wise guys to discover, oh, it's Bethlehem. That's why the Magi then go to Bethlehem. And as we know, Herod flies into a jealous rage, seeing a rival to his own power, and has these children murdered. And we know that, thankfully, an angel visited Joseph in a dream, and the Holy Family depart for Egypt. There's a lot of drama going on here, and drama of good versus evil, and God trying to break into the world, and the enemy of God and the enemy of mankind trying to prevent this from happening.
And it brings us back to the subject at hand, in particular, our appreciation of the three kings, or the Magi, as they're referred to in the Bible, and why honoring their fidelity to a calling and their faithful response, even in the end, where they would go around and not go to the secular authority and say, we need to protect, we need to cherish. I mean, their witness is really a very important one, isn't it?
Yes, their witness with discretion, right? They mm-hmm. didn't return to Herod. They went by a different way. That's a very interesting wisdom that's on display here, that the mystery is for everyone, but sometimes the mystery has to be protected from those who would ill use the information and actually harm the action of God in the world.
Would you say they're indicative of what we now call a group of people who are spiritual but not religious?
The group of people we call spiritual, not religious. Well, you know, that's a diverse group. I mean, some of them, I would, my hat goes off to them because they're true, earnest spiritual seekers. And as we know, Jesus promises, he who seeks will find, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a kind of religious sloth where the demands of religion, you know, the word religion means to bind oneself. That's a commitment. That's mm-hmm. a commitment. And as we all know, commitments of any kind take work, take devotion, take sacrifice. Any commitment that's going to be lived out with any seriousness is going to require all those things. And so there's a kind of religious sloth that, you know, that's a lot of work. Isn't there a way to get like this feel-good stuff and like atmospherics without any price? And mm-hmm. some of this, I'm spiritual but not religious, is that, quite frankly. And it's hard to take it seriously. But there are true spiritual seekers who go in search of the truth, and when they find it, try to live by it.
That's what's so amazing about the three kings or the Magi. It, again, is it brought out in the Bible because they're seeking truth. They're seeking it. And look, they found it. And look how they honored it.
Yes, they bow down and adore the child. They give him these costly gifts. And that's the little book that we're talking about today that, mentions the significance of these gifts and where in the ancient lands these things came from. I found that so interesting. You know, where does myrrh come from? What is frankincense and so on? I learned a lot fleshing out the story from this little book.
Now, again, talk to us about the author. I mean, what has given him this desire to seek this out?
Well, the man who wrote the book, and I'm probably not pronouncing his name correctly, but I've been calling him Grzegorz Zgorny. He's Polish. He's a journalist. He has teamed up with Rosykon Press, Janusz Rosykon, the publisher. He's a world-acclaimed photographer, and they've teamed up on these books. This particular one, Gorny did the search kind of on his own. There are Rosykon photos in here, but Gorny is the one who's telling us the story, going on this kind of pilgrimage, if you will, and motivating him, I think. As we know, Poland was under Soviet communism, and while it was dominated in this way, religious practice was suppressed, Catholics were persecuted, and yet sometimes when you're up against opposition, you become stronger, right? The Polish church was very strong in the communist era. It was the opposition to communism and the Solidarity Labor Union that eventually was so instrumental in toppling the regime. It was very Catholic. Pope John Paul II, as we know, a Pole who backed up these nonviolent movements to resist communism. And so coming out of that experience and now the faith can be practiced without fear, there's now the same kind of dilution of the faith going on in Western Europe that's coming to Poland now that they, you know, that resistance. It's like when you stop going to the gym, your muscles weaken. Well, mm-hmm. When you stop facing resistance for the faith can weaken too, right? And so part of what's motivating the author here is he wants to keep the faith in Poland alive. He wants to help to keep the flame burning. And the way he's doing that is by researching and investigating some of these aspects of the faith, which have been, in your words, Chris, trivialized. Those are just fairy tales. You know, we don't have to believe that stuff. And we don't need that in our lives anymore. We're entering the modern Western European community of nations. We're going to get sophisticated now. And so he's sort of trying to counter that with, no, there's reasons for belief, and faith is a fruitful thing in your life and in our culture, and he wants to keep this alive.
And I think that's, again, the beauty of the wise men that are in the story of Matthew, because in the book, I mean, it's pointed out that Pope Benedict says that you should look at them as those who are seeking, they're striving to understand transcendence. That they're not exactly sure what they're going to encounter, but they're going there. And gosh, you know, especially during these holiday periods, we encounter family members, don't we, that have that same type of yearning. There's something to be said about that journey. But that's what the explosion of all those lights at Epiphany, that it's a light that should be something that draws that seeking soul to it, don't you think?
Well, that's the symbol of the star, right? The star is the focal point. Following that star, that illumination, that transcendent high in the heavens, there's a lot of symbolism here. And yet this little book shows that it might not just be a symbol. There's evidence. Astronomers have discovered quite a bit of evidence for different kinds of stellar phenomena that happened at the time of the birth of Christ that might very well have been the Christmas star, and that these magi, being from Babylon or Persia or wherever they were from, studying the heavens would have taken note of this phenomenon and might very well have been intrigued enough to go in search of an explanation. And knowing Holy Writ, these would have been educated men who'd studied sacred writings and different from different traditions and so on. They might have known the messianic prophecies from the Old Testament that they went in search of. What does this mean? To see in nature a meaning. This was a very common view, a view that's now been discredited. But if God is the creator and everything he made speaks his word, because everything came into being through the word, nature speaks to us. Nature speaks to us about all kinds of things if we have the eyes and the ears that are attentive. And so these wise men, these learned men, they see these things happening in the heavens and they know it means something, but they're not exactly sure what. And they're willing to go take some risks to find out. And isn't that what we're supposed to be doing in our lives? God's speaking to us all the time in nature, in the circumstances in our lives, and the people in our lives. And we're supposed to have eyes and ears open to go in search of what is God saying to me today.
And we touched upon it just a little bit earlier in our conversation, but there is a desire on the hearts of some to trivialize this story, to make it like, oh, it's a nice folktale, or it's a nice addition to this, forgive me, but this cutesy scene. By doing that, though, they discredit the very event in salvation history that is so important. So it's good to recapture the truth of the wise men and their existence, isn't it?
Well, if you can take this out of the story, what else can you take out of the story? You know, once you start chipping away at it, there's not a whole lot left. So mm-hmm. Can we even believe the virgin birth? Can we believe in angels? Can we believe in, I mean, if in fact, if you want to think about it, at least the Magi are men, right? Flesh mm-hmm. and blood individuals. You know, if they're made up, you know, why would you believe in angels? I mean, so if you start chipping away at it, you're going to end up with nothing, which often happens in modern biblical scholarship. You know, if you pick up a book of modern biblical scholarship, you know, at the end of the day, it's so depressing. Everything's been chipped away. But what's so interesting about that is often the starting assumption of that kind of scholarship is, well, we know this can't be believed. Mm-hmm. Oh, you do? You know that can't be believed? Why is that your starting assumption? Why not have that openness and wonder that these three wise men must have had? And your starting point might be, anything is possible. How do I know what the limits of the God of the universe are? And so start out with that wonder and see where it leads you, as opposed to starting out with your own limitations. And what's interesting is that some of the things that have been thrown out by biblical scholars have now been proved through archaeological evidence. You know, certain cities that they said never existed. Therefore, the story, you know, like the Nineveh or Bethsaida, a city that Jesus mentions in the Gospels of having been destroyed or will be destroyed. And biblical scholars, oh, that's obviously hyperbole. That city doesn't exist. Guess what? Archaeologists have just found it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So sometimes these things get thrown out on the assumption it couldn't be true, turn out to be true. So yes, we have to have that. Well, what did Jesus say? You have to be like a child. And children are full of that wonder and that openness to possibility that as we get bumped along the road and scraped up a bit and bruised a bit, we become hardened and jaded and cynical. And the story then has less and less power. The whole Christmas story has less and less power in our lives. And we don't want that to happen. We want to stay open to God.
Well, I hope we have our listeners desiring to follow this beautiful star. Actually, it's a book. Go find it. It's called Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, and we've been speaking to its editor, Vivian Doudreau. And Vivian, I wish we had more time, because this is such a lovely work. It really, truly is. Any final thoughts?
Well, I love that scene in Brideshead Revisited where the Catholic character is being challenged by the non-believer, and the non-believer is saying, well, you don't believe all that stuff, do you? You know, those stories like the three kings and whatnot. And the believer answers, oh, I do. They're lovely stories. And the challenger says, you can't believe in something just because it's a lovely story. And the believer says, well, I do. Yeah. So the fact is that even without the search for evidence, whether it's historical, astronomical, factual, you know, there's a lot we can't know for certain. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you open yourself to God and you take these stories in, because we start with the people who wrote them had a seriousness of purpose that I take seriously. Something happened that changed the lives of the people who encountered Christ when he walked this earth. And I've encountered Christ in my own life, and that encounter has already been transformative for me. And with just those two things, I can enter the stories of the Gospels and have amazing things happen. And I don't even, I mean, this book is great because it's interesting and intriguing and you learn some things and whatever. But the beauty of it is I don't even need this to believe. God's mm-hmm. already entered my life and done amazing things. And I have every expectation he's going to continue to do so, so as long as I keep searching for him.
Beautiful. Vivian, this is just a delight. I appreciate your presence with us once again. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
With Vivian Doudreau, we've gone inside the pages of Three Kings, Ten Mysteries. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.